Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. For new and returning listeners, you may know that you can find the podcast on minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com or on Twitter at minoritiesinpub. And this is the newest episode. We've been more consistent this year, and I'm so happy to have Annie Koyama, publisher of Koyama Press, on today, and she is in Toronto.
Correct. Hi.
Yes. And Koyama Press, this is the 10-year anniversary, no?
Yeah, it is, and it feels like 40 years.
Is anything big planned or not so much?
Yep, lots of things. Our biggest show is in like 1 month tomorrow, the Toronto Comic Arts Festival that a lot of people come up from the U.S. for. People come from all over the world, in fact, to be guests. So we've got a lot. We're bringing in a whole bunch of artists, and in addition, I've done a lot of extra promotional material this year.
Oh, fantastic. So when I saw, I was like, oh, snap, 10 years. That's a huge milestone for a small publisher.
It is, particularly because in small press publishing, it's very, very difficult. There's not much money in it, and the people that you're making books with are not being paid much because the market is not wide. It's just, it's hard for everyone. So most people are doing it really out of love. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, but we also have to eat and we have rent to pay and that kind of thing. You're in New York. In Toronto, the rents are sky high. The cost of living is pretty nuts here. And so, sadly, like New York, there has been an exodus of artists having to move out of town.
So is Toronto the New York of Canada?
Yep, you could say that about Vancouver for housing prices too on the West Coast. But mm-hmm. Toronto is more, I think, probably more of an arts hub than Vancouver. Mm-hmm. We have a million artists of all stripes here. It's just very hard to make a living, and it's getting very impossible to afford a studio space mm-hmm. if you're an artist and mm-hmm. can't work, you know, at home. So it's nothing new. All the big cities are experiencing this. I watched the migration in certain U.S. cities, like people leaving Portland. Mm-hmm. You know, the way in maybe 10 years ago, people were going over to Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And then last year, I heard that Brooklyn was so expensive in parts that a lot of people were moving back to Manhattan because the rents were cheaper.
Yep, that's accurate.
That's crazy.
It's a little bit redonkulous, as I like to say, because I said, but I'm kind of glad about that, because I say, if you don't move to Queens, then my rent stays relatively low.
Right, like, right.
So I'm scared of that mass, all these people coming further into Queens. They've already hit the tip of Queens. Uh-huh. So I live deeper in, and the rent is, I'm using air quotes, reasonable.
Yes.
I am. So artists stay in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well, they just have to move further and further out.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel you on that.
Yep.
It kind of leads into the question of, because you said doing a small press is a labor of love and staying with it is a labor of love. Mm-hmm. And you got into publishing. It was a, like, I don't want to say it for you. I'd love for that to come from you in terms of how exactly Koyama Press started.
Okay.
But it obviously is a labor of love, and it was a career switch for you.
Absolutely. So how I got into it, I have no publishing background whatsoever. I did not go to school to learn about publishing. I went for arts and languages and, in fact, criminology. Mm. I think at one point I wanted to be a social worker and do corrections work, but long story short, I got sick and wasn't able to work for quite a while. And then about 11 years ago, I was diagnosed with terminal brain aneurysm and sent home to die, actually. So prior to that, I'd worked in advertising. I was actually a film producer. I started in documentary. I love documentary. I still love documentary. Mm-hmm. That might be my first love in film. But, you know, documentary is like making comics. You're going to mm-hmm. be poor forever. So anyone out there making documentaries, my hat goes off to them, because it's very much the same as, you know, people doing comics in my part of the comic sphere. But, so I was in film. After I pushed for a risky surgery and had it and then did not die and survived, I decided I didn't want to go back to advertising. I didn't like advertising. I liked the film making commercials. I liked the film production part of it a lot, but I hated the other part. So it was time to leave. So I made a plan to leave and had saved up a lot of money because you're paid well in advertising. And I just wanted to travel around for maybe up to 2 years. And then I got sick and couldn't do that. So when I was unable to work, I'm pretty much an A-type person. So you can imagine you can only watch so many baseball games and read so many books at home before you get bored. And I had this travel money all saved up, so I thought, you know, I'm going to play the stock market. What the hell? I'm not going to go nuts here, but I'm going to try because why not? I'm prepared to lose a little bit to win a bit, and I did pretty well doing that. So by the time I was able to do something new, I decided I'm definitely not going back to advertising. I'm probably not going back to film. I've got this money because I wasn't able to travel, but now, you know, I've got this savings and I don't have much debt or anything. What can I use it on? So I started to find illustrators in Toronto, and I would choose a person and learn a little bit about them and meet up with them and tell them that I would fund a project that they chose to do, whether it be making letterpress prints, even, you know, silkscreen t-shirts, little zines or that kind of thing. And they could make something, but there had to be a product that came out of it that they could sell. And then I gave them they could keep all the proceeds. They just gave me a few copies. They got to keep everything they made from that and hopefully then have like a little bit of money to do the next project. So one of the people I found early on was a fellow called Clayton Hanmer. He's known professionally as Cton, C-T-O-N. He's now a pretty successful kids illustrator. He's got several books that way. But I met him, and he introduced me to two other wonderful fellows, Steve Wilson and Aaron Layton. And they do this thing where they go once a week to this student bar in town and they just doodle and they trade sketchbooks, and their sketchbooks are fantastic. So I remember looking and watching them and saying, gee, you know, that stuff would make a great book. And we all agreed, and then we all realized we weren't really sure how to make a book. But we did. We decided to do it and we figured it out. And then I sold my car and sent them to this show in Japan, in Tokyo, that fall. And, you know, I guess that was the beginning of, making books, this is fun. It wasn't super hard to actually make the book. I mean, the guys did all the work of the content. Obviously, the harder part you don't find out until later is selling it and getting a book distributed. That's the hardest part. So that's how I accidentally fell into publishing, because after that book, I wanted to do more. And I did do more. So 10 years later, I'm still doing more.
So you were kind of giving out artist grants, basically.
I was. Yeah, I was. There were no strings. I don't like to work that way ever. So, yeah, it was great. I met some wonderful people, did some great projects. I remained friends with, you know, everybody from, you know, day one. It's been pretty amazing. So it expanded a world to me. I didn't know about alternative comics, and that might lead into another question for you.
Because the group has expanded. It's still a small group, but when did you formally get your team together?
Oh, well, not for about 6 years. I mean, I'm a workaholic and I don't sleep much. I have insomnia. So I did everything. I worked 24/7 for about 6 years.
Wow.
And then my money ran out. And then I had to start working more traditionally. Also, I needed help because by then I had a lot of books. It's very, very difficult. It's a ton of work. The marketing part's a ton of work. You know, all the behind-the-scenes stuff, it takes a lot of time. You have to be on social media really a lot until you want to, you know, push your computer off the balcony, but that kind of thing. But, yeah, so about maybe 6 years in, I found Ed Canerva. He works with me now full-time. He does production and marketing, and he does much more. He comes to shows with me. He's also a fantastic right-hand person, but I hired him full-time after having him for a very short time as a part-time worker. I just realized once I started with that, it was like, oh my God, I need somebody full-time. In fact, I need somebody full-time, go back 3 years. So I should have brought him on sooner, but you know, hindsight is everything, I guess.
Yeah. So when you were doing everything yourself, you were talking about the learning curve. Did that help you solidify exactly what you wanted from your team when you did start to bring people on?
Well, I didn't really have a team, and it was just me and Ed for quite a while. Mm-hmm. In the last few years, I brought Helen Koyama, who happens to be my sister, mm-hmm. on, and she's filled, you know, a lot of gaps also. Mm-hmm. And just this year, we now have a part-time intern, and I believe in people working without pay, so even people who are interning for me are paid. And so right now I've got 2 part-timers, mm-hmm. and Ed, 1 full-time person, but really I did everything for all those early years by myself. Now, I didn't have a real distributor, so I had a few people helping me that were getting it out at mostly in the U.S., you know, very small one-person distributor, but not a big company that did it and got them into bookstores and Barnes and Noble and that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So once that happened to me, I really, really needed Ed, because it's a ton of work and mm-hmm. it's a whole different world. You have to work so differently. I have to plan really a couple years ahead, and that nobody works that way in the beginning unless they have to.
Yeah.
So that was that's mm-hmm. a big adjustment.
Mm-hmm. I'm a production editor, so we always have to think backwards.
Yep. That's crazy. So people don't realize, you know, when I talk to somebody now about doing their book for 2019 or maybe 2020, it just seems, I'm sure sometimes they're a little crestfallen because it seems like a gazillion years away, mm-hmm. you know, especially if they're most of the way through a book already and they're going to be giving it to me this year in 2017, but, you know, not actually see it on the roster for 2 more years.
Yeah.
I can see how that's frustrating. I mean, in your development as an artist, hopefully you're growing every year and things are changing. And even, you know, over the course of 1 year, you might look back at that work that you handed in to me and is, you know, on the road to coming out as a book, and maybe not like the work so much anymore, even after a year, depending on the kind of person you are.
Mm.
So that happens, but it's just how publishing works, unfortunately.
You seem very zen about all this.
Oh, sure. I mean, I had nothing to lose because I wasn't using anybody else's money at the beginning. I could do anything I wanted to. Nobody was the boss of me.
Mm-hmm.
I could do, you know, porny stuff. I did do porny, weirdo stuff. I did stuff I didn't care whether it sold 50 copies or 500 copies.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have those constraints. Of course, if you don't have those constraints, of course you're going to be more zen about stuff. I mean, I fret over stuff. I'm a perfectionist and I like things to be right. So that thing, that's never changed. That's just part of my personality. So that will always add stress. But, you know, shit is always going to happen. You know, things happen. There's always going to be, you're going to make mistakes. I mean, pretend you, Jennifer, are starting tomorrow and you've had enough of what you're doing and you decide you want to be something tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
A dancer tomorrow, but you've never danced. You're starting from, you know, day one,
mm-hmm.
and you're not 18 years old. Any learning curve, you just have to be ready to climb a big, big hill. I like to work, and I especially like to work after I wasn't able to work for quite a while due mm-hmm. to illness. It's not in my nature, so I've got a pretty weirdly, probably overly strong work ethic.
Mm-hmm. It's the flip side, because speaking to self-published artists, they're so connected to the work that they can't be that critic that they need to be when they're doing
right.
everything themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. It's great to talk to you as someone who was, like I said, you know, it was like originally it seemed like giving grants, no strings attached, but then it became a formal publishing process.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not the artist, so you can bring that editorial eye to the work.
I can, but the way I choose to work is, it's not like in superhero comics that I grew up with where there's a writer and an artist that mm-hmm. draws the comic. I prefer to work with one artist, and I'm sure that, you know, by reading any book that's by one person, some of them may not be strong writers, but amazing artists, and vice versa. You'll definitely see that in the range of books that I have. But it's how I prefer to work. I also don't edit with a heavy hand. That's not the kind of publisher I want to be. We're very hardcore on copy editing, that you don't get a pass on typos and that kind of thing. That you don't, you know, I'm going to be very forceful about. That stuff has to be right. But beyond that, some artists will like a lot of editing and are open to it, and some don't want, they just don't want much. That can be tough sometimes because covers are really important, for instance.
Yeah.
You may know as an artist what you like. Just because you're a good artist doesn't necessarily mean you're a good designer. That's the truth. So,
That's
you know,
true.
Some of these things need tweaking for different reasons too. I know what booksellers need to see. You can be as artistic as you want and not pay attention to that, but there is money on the line when someone is publishing a book for you. I mean, if I'm going to do that, I'm investing, you know, a lot of time and money, a lot of time into you and your book. And so to do that and then to get it out into a bookstore and not care that much about how well it does, when you could make a few tweaks that you know would make it more attractive to a retailer to display a certain way, or more, you know, a title that is a little more legible for the public to pick up who don't know you already. In our little corner of comics, a lot of people know each other. So there's the sort of assumption sometimes, I think, that it's like everyone knows my work and, you know, they know how I draw and this kind of thing. And my job is to get you a wider audience and to get it out to the big bookstores where they may just have a few comics and it's a mostly literary, you know, trade literary bookstore. You really have to work a little harder than to have your book picked up, even though graphic novels now, you know, have definitely broken through in bookstores versus comic stores.
Well, that leads to the other question I had, because you said you invest in these artists and they're the writer as well as the artist, but sometimes there's stuff, you know, like the diary comics and stuff like that might not be as arduous as like creating something that's paneled and a specific story or graphic novel.
Well, most of the diary comics that I have done are paneled. If they're not, read less as a comic. Julie Delport is a wonderful artist who lives in Montreal.
Yeah, her journal is gorgeous. I love that book.
Yeah, but that's a different way. I mean, if you pick that up in a bookstore and someone said, oh, that's a good comic, you'd be going, that's maybe not even a comic, right?
Yeah, right.
But then you pick up Dustin Harbin's little tight, super tight, small diary comics, and those are clearly comics. Julia Wirtz's autobio are clearly comics in, you know, the panel format that you would recognize right away as a comic.
And Jane May's?
Jane May. Yeah, who is in Jersey City now.
Get out. Oh, so she's close to me.
Well,
anyways.
Yeah, she pushed out of Brooklyn. She is one of those people. Anyway, she's amazing.
Yeah, her art is beautiful.
Yeah, she's hilarious. I think people don't get how smart she is. I don't think they actually get how funny she is sometimes. Her stuff is really deep.
Yeah.
I'm very excited about a new book that she and a woman from Ottawa, Canada, did. That's coming out in TCAF next month, and it's called So Pretty, Very/Very Rotten, and it's a book looking into Lolita culture.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that's unusual in that, you know, after I just said I generally work with one artist on a book, they both did comics in this book, but Anne had written a lot of text, and we brought in some other people, so there's text, more text in that book.
So when you work with these artists, how have you found the time commitment to be? Because what I don't see working in book publishing is that commitment from editors/publishers. There's the commitment to produce the book, but not necessarily to help someone create this content. And I know you said sometimes it depends on the artist. Sometimes they want a lot of editing. Sometimes they want a little editing. But, you know, you're specific to like making it look good, making it presentable, attractive. How has been that kind of work dynamic thus far?
Well, again, I don't think I ever will want to be a heavy editor. So I think if someone wanted a ton of input, they're probably at the wrong company. They should go elsewhere. There are, as you know, bigger firms who very will assign you an editor and work on your book the same way they would a prose book. My suggestions are much of a different kind. I've encountered something in comics that tends to show up, and there are people who are doing 10 pages of something, and the payoff after the 10 pages, it's not enough to warrant the 10 pages. And so a couple times I've asked gently if make that story a bit shorter, it'll just work. I'm reading it as a fan of their work, obviously, if I already am working with them. But I also have to read with a critical eye in a way that the public, you who've never heard of this person or seen this book, nor their work, seeing it for the first time, I want it to be cohesive as much as possible. I have done over the years several collections of people's work, and they are what they are. They're collections. They're not always easy to make cohesive, but if it's something that is, if someone does, they're not everyone has a long story in them. Not everyone wants to do that, is even interested in doing that. So I think that there will always be somewhat people like that that I'll be working with, where the editing, I guess, comes in moving the stories around, the order of them, and maybe shortening some the odd time. But really, that is the extent. Like, I don't rewrite dialogue or anything, aside from the copy editing part. We make suggestions, but after the typos, I leave it to the artists as to whether they want to take the suggestions for that kind of editing. And I'm not heavy about it.
So is it you get mostly referrals, or you're kind of constantly seeking out people?
No, I don't need referrals. I found everybody virtually, because I don't sleep at first. I was looking up stuff in the early Tumblr days. Even before that, when people had websites, I haven't ever had a problem finding people. I mean, in Toronto alone, there's a great community, and once you find somebody, then you can, oh my God, they'll introduce me to someone. Michael DeForge is one of the earliest people I've worked with, and possibly has had the most success out of the people who I've worked with who were not known when I first published them. And he, in the early days, introduced me to several other local people, some of whom I ended up publishing. So I don't take submissions. We only do, 10 to 12, maybe 13 books a year. So, once you're in year five or whatever, you want to keep working with some of the people you've already worked with. And some people work very quickly and they can do a book a year, and some people need 5 years between books. Because it's so hard to make a living in what we do, when the show Adventure Time started up at Cartoon Network, they sucked a lot of people from our comics world over to work on that show, and some of them moved to LA, which is great. And it was great because that's what they would like to do, and also they're making a proper wage for a change. So I can't begrudge anybody that. However, it meant that, instead of getting a book from somebody I wanted to work with again, I might have to wait 2 years or 3 years or even longer in one case. And that's okay. I'd rather they be happy and be paying their rent.
And it's a good look for Koyama Press too, to be that stepping stone, if anything, I would
For
think.
sure. But I mean, and that was true in the early days, but when you've invested so much into certain people and done three books with them, you want to just keep working with them. There are people I've worked with, and I haven't taken every book from them. There are people whose work I love out there in the community, like people with, really good reputations and done wonderful work, but the book that they brought to me wasn't necessarily the one that I liked the best. And so I have passed for that reason, even to be honest, on with some of the people that I've worked with over the years. I might have pushed them a little bit into a different direction. If I can't be behind any of these books 100%, I can't do it. It's not worth it to the artist. You're really not treating them fairly, I think, by taking that on. I know that big companies, just by virtue of time and not enough staff, if you're doing a lot more books than the amount that I'm doing a year, you don't have time to be spending as much time as I do per book to market it and you know, talk to people and be on Facebook about it. Mm-hmm. So I get that, but it's also a bigger time commitment on Ed's part and my part. And so I have to love it.
And that's what we usually hear on the editor's, I mean, the writer's side, is someone says, oh, I don't love it. But like talking to you about it, I feel like I get, and I hope other artists, they really get the reason why it needs to be a love relationship, like a love relationship, because of this investment of time. And I don't mm-hmm. know that we get it as much with the bigger publishers. It's like, oh, I don't love it, but sometimes it feels like, oh, I just don't know how to sell it. Whereas from you, it sounds like I'll find a way because I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm atypical in that, you know, at least for the first 6 years, I didn't have to care so much about revenue. I didn't care as much if a book didn't do that well. I don't regret any book I've ever published, but, mm-hmm. you know, I'd be lying if I said they were all great sellers. Mm-hmm. They're not. I knew some of them were not going to be from day one, mm-hmm. but I didn't really care, even doing art books, which is a whole different subject.
Oh, yeah.
When I first started, that's what I wanted to do, but the two bigger art books stores in Toronto closed that very year.
What?
And yeah, so there was, you know, fewer places to sell it. I didn't have a proper distributor at that time, and so why bash your head against the wall? And it doesn't make any sense to be making a product that no one's going to see. So I have had to be pragmatic that way. But yeah, I mean, you know, when you're doing stuff for love, the bigger companies, they have way more money behind them, so they don't have to care as much. I mean, if you are an editor hired by a large publisher, I don't honestly think you have to love the books you're working on. It's a job. I think the best editors do impart some of their good wisdom and make a book better. Mm-hmm. I think in the best case scenario, that's what happens. But at our level, the stakes are way lower. Nobody's making much money off of this. And so you really have to be doing it for other reasons and also be passionate about it, because really, I'm not being paid much. I've got overhead. I have to take care of the people that I want, but mm-hmm. I want to get this book out there. You know, you really have to get behind it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of competition out there right now. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a different decision for a small press person like me.
Do people seem to have realistic expectations, especially being with Koyama Press, and that it's a small press, that this is alternative comic?
The artists, you mean? The authors?
Mm-hmm.
I guess sometimes. I think often because they're emerging, they have no idea of what to expect. And so there are people who are, you know, concerned with how many books we sell. And I just tell them, that's not why I'm in this. You know, obviously, I want to sell as many as we can. But I don't want them feeling like they're a failure if they didn't sell as many books as their the friend they went to school with.
Mm.
Who's an artist and now has their own TV show from their book and just happens to draw cats or something, which is like so, so popular. If you draw a cat, people will buy a book. It's crazy.
Really?
Yeah, it's like, I mean, there's certain themes that are more popular, that kind of thing. If you're in it because you want to make money and you want to sell a ton of copies, then you're going to write about certain things and mm-hmm. you're going to avoid certain things. Yeah. That's not the kinds of books I want to do. Mm-hmm. If by accident, you know, I luck into, you know, Sue Kim's cat person, you know, talks about her cat really a lot. And then people who love cats are going to buy a ton of this book because they love cats. And then they'll discover her work, find out that, you know, her work is pretty great too. I'm not complaining because that has helped me sell that book better. But I never want to be the guy that is like, oh, the cat publisher, that kind of thing. That won't be me. But if I had a bigger company or if I changed the mandate of my company, I'd have to be going for themes or for bigger names to begin with, not work with emerging artists that uh-huh. nobody knows. It is 10 times the work to try and market and get publicity and get attention from the press for an unknown person, no matter how good they are. We spend a ton of our time breaking down walls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's taken me 9 or 10 years to get into art form and certain things that I've been sending them books since day one. You just have to be at a certain level and be noticed by certain people. If you're a larger company, you can hire publicists. You may have a publicist on staff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can't afford to do that with the budgets on our books. So we just work a lot harder. Now, obviously it's doable because I would argue that we're pretty successful that way. But it's a lot of work and it's a lot of me beating on doors for many, many years. And now Ed helps beat down doors with me really a lot. So we're getting there, but that's hard. It's difficult.
It
No,
is.
there are some days when I think, oh my God, I should just work with so and so who approached me because I don't, everyone knows them already. They're going to buy their book whether it's good or not, you know. But I can't do that because if I don't love the book, it's not really how I want to work.
And that goes into the next question with the marketing and publicity. Because I mentioned when I talked to you earlier with the questions was Comic Cons. I went to New York Comic Con, which has blown up exponentially in the past few years, and I know San Diego as well. But it seems like it's so mired in the big names. It's so mired in media and not so much comics, which has been a big concern that people have had about it. So, how do smaller publishers, alternative comic publishers specifically, what are the cons to go to get noticed? Because it seems like that's not the type of one you
No,
might want to go to.
I'll say I have no interest in going to that Comic Con. I've never been to San Diego Comic Con. Well, you know, it might be fun to go as a civilian for a day or something. I could sell some books there. I have been told to go there and be in the small press area. It's not the kind of, they're not coming for Koyama Press books. They're coming for the next Guardians of the Galaxy
Oh,
toy,
yeah. Oh,
the
yeah.
next movie trailers, and they're coming to meet, you know, the guy who plays Thor, who I love.
They're coming for the
No.
Walking Dead cast. That's what they're
Well,
coming
yeah, absolutely. They're not coming for a
for.
Jesse Jacobs book, you know, much as I would like to. You know, pull them over to my booth. The fees at that kind of show are they're way too high for somebody like me. Anyway, so I would never do that kind of show. It's just not really our people, to be honest. And I know this will sound a little biased, but you know, my homey show is the Toronto show. We have Fan Expo here in Toronto, and there's Anime North. So there's all kinds of other kinds of comic shows here. They're quite big, both of those, but they're not really our audience, even though I have done Fan Expo one time and did sell some books. And we've had the odd one of our book at Anime North, for instance, and do okay. But the bulk of what I sell would be at TCAF, the Toronto Comic Arts Festival in May. The other bigger one is Small Press Expo, SPX. Takes place in September, mid-September in Bethesda. I think it's actually Rockville, Washington.
Oh, okay. So does that change every year? The XPX?
No, that's been held, you know, way before my time. So that's a very good one for us. And then there was one in Brooklyn for a long time, and it's had two iterations. So that used to be a very good one. I think it's come back in the last couple of years, but oh geez, it was BC Brooklyn Comics, something like that. It was a few years ago, and then I can't remember now because, of course, it got replaced with Comic Arts Brooklyn, CAB, CAB. But then the person who ran it took a break one year, and then that timing coincided with our dollar dropping so much. So every time I enter the U.S., even if I want to come into Trump's America now, I you know, which honestly, it gives me pause,
I
as
don't
a
blame
person of
you.
color.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
I really
So
don't.
anyway, it doesn't make sense for us to. I can't really do that. I just lose too much going over the border. I'll never make enough to make that worthwhile until the dollar gets better. I like that show a lot, and I hope I can come back at some point. But right now, it's tough.
I think it's Comics Arts Brooklyn, what you were saying.
Yeah.
And we have some people who come to Brooklyn Book Fest because there are they're usually graphic novelists. Cartoonists definitely come to Brooklyn Book Fest.
Yep, I've had my books there. When you're a small publisher and you can't afford to do the travel, if you have, you know, allies and other small publishers, I'm good friends with the fellows at Secret Acres. And until recently, both of them lived in New York or Brooklyn. One is in Brooklyn. And they repped me one year. They sold my books for me.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but to be honest, that That is more of a literary fest.
It
It's
is.
not really, people aren't really comics, so it doesn't, again, make much financial sense with the dollar for me ever to table at that show. It's not really our audience. I mean, it's great to, if you had all the money in the world and you could just go to a show like that and expand your audience, that's really fun. But, bottom line stuff is bottom line.
Oh yeah, and there's an oversaturation point too, because if you have 100 vendors, realistically, how many vendors can one person, if they should go to an event all day, see and interact with?
Oh yeah. Well, and beyond the interacting, to even be more crass, people come with a certain amount of money in their pocket. I've been to so many shows with, comic guys coming up and we'll be near the front door and they'll come and say hi to us and, "Oh my God, these are so great. I really want to get this." And then they go, "Oh, I only have $25 for the whole show," like over 2 days. And so, yeah, I'm just gonna
What?
look around and I'll come back. And some of them do, but lots of them do not. So if it's not a lot for, what books cost now.
No, it's
The other thing
not.
is pretty obvious, and it hurts a lot of people like us, even though I can't, on the subject of Amazon, they do obviously sell a lot of books for us, and I get that if you're not near a comic or a bookstore, you live out somewhere far away from there, if you are an international fan or reader, and if you don't have very much money, I how can I, criticize someone who buys our book at that discount versus going to a bookstore? But I am going to sternly say to anybody listening to this, once you post that, some of those people will do that, but then they'll also be the first to be grumpy when their local bookstore closes and they haven't, in fact, bought a book from their bookseller 2 blocks away in 5 years. So, dudes, you're part of the problem. So, think about that, how valuable you want these bookstores, to be around.
Yeah, we're having, I mean, we're having the same issue in New York. Queens, the borough of Queens, now has one independent bookstore because all the
Wow.
Barnes and Nobles closed last year. And another one is trying to go on the way. And then the Bronx, there's a woman, Noelle Dos Santos, who just, she opens a pop-up because the Bronx has no bookstores. So she
Wow.
opened a pop-up. Like Brooklyn has all the indie bookstores.
Yeah, totally, totally.
And it t speaks to the commerce. I mean, Manhattan does too, but Brooklyn and Manhattan are the places where the independents are and the Barnes and Nobles that remain are. So the
Right.
rest of us in the other outer boroughs are really screwed in
Yep,
terms of
yep.
getting material and comics. A lot of the comic book
Yep.
shops in Queens close too.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah. So we
You have
rely
to
on like
go,
Forbidden
yeah.
Planet.
No. I mean, like I say, I understand. If you're also helping putting your local book people out of business, maybe think about it before you buy from Amazon.
Oh, absolutely. I want people to like support their indies and then maybe make an indie. Not saying that's in easy, not saying that's easy. There's a lot of
No.
kick crowdfunding, but I would like to see the advent of more indies happen in the bor outer boroughs that aren't Brooklyn.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to, how much of a market there is, and location is everything. That real estate thing, location, location, location. It's definitely, you can be noble and start something up, but if you pick the wrong street where there's no walk-by traffic because that's the only place where the storefront is rentable and affordable, there's no point opening. You're just going to be closing that year. So it's catch 22.
It really is. And the rent prices, like we said at the beginning of the episode, are ridiculous. Yeah, it's spacing, it's inventory, it's knowing your people. So I mean, it's such an interesting difference because the publisher, you as publisher, are publishing what you believe in, and then a bookseller is trying to figure out what fits for their area and geographic region, so to speak. So, yeah,
Not easy.
no, it's not. There is a new indie bookstore called Books Are Magic happening in
I've heard of
Brooklyn.
it.
Yeah, Emma Straub. So hopefully she
Okay.
will have a nice comic section because a lot of the Brooklyn bookstores do not have comics, I will say.
Right.
They have graphic novels, but they have like from the big publishers.
Understood.
Yeah, so I would hope that they would implement that and get the small pubs as well. I'm kind of speaking to the choir, I know, but you know, like, if Emma Straub, if I run into her again, like, definitely gonna put that on her radar. So thank you so much, Annie, for taking the time to talk to me about
the Yama Press.
And happy 10-year anniversary. Like I said, that's a huge deal. That's huge.
It is. Thank you so much.
And I'm glad you've been able to publish what you want.
Yeah, I think if that day comes when that's not the case, I'll probably be done.
I find this a refreshing conversation to talk to a publisher, and I hope, because a lot of the people who listen tend to be emerging artists and people who want to enter the industry. So I think this is might be very refreshing to hear from someone who's, I'm just doing what I want. Not that it's easy, but I'm doing what I want. And I, you know.
You know, I don't think I could have done it any other way. But I think if I'd gone back and known what was involved in publishing, it might have given me pause to get in when I got in. But I do like a challenge, on the other hand. So I'm still here.
And are there any upcoming books you'd especially like to recommend?
The one that I talked to you about, So Pretty, Very Rotten. Eleanor Davis is a wonderful artist, and she's got a new one in May with us called You and a Bike and a Road. Jesse Jacobs is a local, just outside of Toronto artist. I've worked with him a few times. He's got a psychedelic, fabulous one called Crawl Space. Crawl Space, mm-hmm. Yep. And Eric Kostiak-Williams is a Toronto artist, and he is tackling in his new little comic the horrible gentrification that's happening because of all the condo building in Toronto.
Really?
And that one's called Condo Heartbreak Disco.
I need to get that one because that's a universal theme.
It totally is. But I also do kids' comics. And Ben Sears is a Louisville, Kentucky artist, and he's bringing out his second book in a series for, you know, all ages, but maybe, I don't know, 5, 7 and up.
Mm-hmm.
So that one's called Volcano Trash.
Aww.
And Kyler Roberts is a wonderful artist in Chicago, and she does autobiocomics, and she's bipolar, and she's very dry, she's witty, she's hilarious, and they're just raw, honest, and her book is called Sunburning. All of those will debut in 1 month.
1 month? Wow, that's a lot in 1 month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very exciting.
And just to reiterate or really emphasize for listeners, how can people reach out to Koyama Press to buy, not to submit?
Okay, to buy, obviously local bookstores and comic stores first, but if you can't, you know, anywhere online, the A word. Yeah, or come see us at shows. If you're in Toronto, by all means, there's a show called Cake in Chicago in June, early June. Some of our artists will be there as special guests, and our books will be there, SPX in September. We do local zine shows in Toronto, so if you're up here, you can find us at Zine Dream. I think it's in August.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure it's happening again. And we might pop up at another book fair, but just a couple things to be determined. Sorry, the one more that's really exciting is Ed and Helen, who work with me, are going to wrap us at the Kaigai Manga Festival in Tokyo, Japan in November.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So get to Tokyo. Well, I wanted to go back to the books because you also do some in digital editions, yes? So some are available via Comixology. I don't know if the newer ones will also be available.
Not yet, but soon they will.
Okay.
But not quite yet. They're not even out yet. So I like to have them in print first a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And also Sequential is another wonderful place that's run out of England. They had our books digitally first. So those two places.
And it's koyamapress.com.
Correct.
And you're also on Twitter and Facebook.
I am, although I may be on as Annie Koyama or Kick-Ass Annie on one of them.
Yeah, I love those drawings.
Yeah, there is a Facebook page for Koyama Press.
Yeah, I love those Kick-Ass Annie drawings. Those are really cute.
Oh, my God. Well, Aaron Layton, who was one of the Trio Magnus guys from the first book, he created the logo early on, so I owe him a huge debt because there's over 300 versions of that logo avatar now.
And you can see a handful on the Koyama Press site.
They just gave up after a while. There were just too many to post. Maybe Dan, our intern, can get around to adding some more.
So there's like a B-side to the Kick-Ass Annie logo.
Absolutely, yeah. Anyway, have a look.
Well, thank you again so much, Annie, for being
thank
on.
Thank you, Jen.
And thank you for producing what you produce in the alternative comic world. It's amazing.
Wonderful.
Journal, especially, by Julie Delport. Oh, my goodness. So beautiful. You just want to hang it up on your wall. It's so good.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, again, this is Jen with the Minorities in Publishing podcast, which you can find at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com and Minorities in Pub on Twitter, as well as iTunes. You can also find it on iTunes, so feel free to rate. I'll talk to you next episode. Thanks, and take care.